The Florida Everglades are full of fascinating wildlife, eerie beauty, and countless natural wonders. But within this dense wilderness is the story of a man believed to be one of Florida's most prolific serial killers, and the people who decided to take justice into their own hands to stop him from murdering again. This is the mystery of Edgar Watson, the desperado of Chatham Bend. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. When you think of outlaws and fugitives in 19th century America, you more than likely think of the Old West, Texas, Oklahoma, Arizona, cowboys, saloons, and gunfights. But for many outlaws in the American West, there was a refuge when they had no other option to escape the law. They could flee south to the Florida Everglades. Modern day, the Everglades National Park is a 1.5 million acre wetlands preserve on the southern tip of the state of Florida. The Everglades has been described as a grassy, slow-moving river made up of coastal mangroves, sawgrass marshes, and pine flatwoods. Hundreds of species of animals live within the Everglades. It's an area of the United States that's constantly being explored, but back in the 1890s, the Everglades were known as more of a dismal, desolate, and lonely place than you could ever imagine. One explorer described the Everglades as a God-abandoned hellscape. Edgar Watson was an outlaw who made the choice to exchange the dust and vast open spaces of the Old West for rivers, swamps, mosquitoes, and alligators within that hellscape of the Everglades. He eluded the law and tried to escape a past full of murder and violence. When darkness is a part of you, you're able to control it and keep it at bay for a while. But as Edgar Watson learns, eventually it surfaces, and you'll pay for it in unexpected ways. Edgar Watson was born on November 11th of 1855 in Ridge Springs, South Carolina. He was the son of Elijah Watson and Ellen Addison. Edgar's father, Elijah, was known as Ring Eye Lige because of a circular scar around one eye that he got in a knife fight. Ring Eye Lige was a Confederate veteran of the Civil War who had been hardened and embittered by war and turned to alcohol. Lige had a violent nature and would often beat his son, Edgar. Eventually, Edgar's mother fled South Carolina with her children and set up a new home in Lake City, Florida. It was in Florida that Edgar began to show that he was much like his father. Edgar took to drinking and, like his father, became extremely violent when he was drunk. Despite his violent nature, Edgar did meet and marry Jane Dial in January of 1882. Not long after the marriage, Edgar started a fight with a man and killed him with a knife. And Edgar decided to run to avoid arrest and imprisonment. He fled to Arkansas, but hiding out proved to be a challenge for Ed. He was over 6 feet tall, with red hair and a beard, and hands and feet that seemed visibly too small for a man of his size. Continuing to drink and fight led to Ed killing more men in his fits of rage, and hiding out became harder and harder. Ed moved on into the Indian Territories in what we now know as the state of Oklahoma, where he was said to have rented a house from Belle Starr, a woman who was to become known as the Queen of the Outlaws. Belle helped Ed hide out, but when she heard he was wanted for murder, she told Ed he needed to move on. He refused, and it said that Belle threatened Ed and told him if he didn't move on, she would report him to the law. Shortly after that exchange, Belle Starr was murdered. Belle Starr was immortalized as the Queen of Outlaws in the dime store novels of the 19th century. But much of what's been written about Belle in those novels and portrayed in movies and music, it's just not true. Belle's life wasn't as exciting as some believed for generations. But her death at the age of 40, well, that's what made Belle Starr famous. Belle was born Myra Maybelle Shirley. Her father was a prosperous innkeeper in Carthage, Missouri. Belle was a teenager when the Civil War started, and the war changed her family's life. Her older brother, Bud, began riding with Quantrill's Raiders, some of the most notorious pro-Confederate bushwhackers who fought in the war. Their leader was William Quantrill. Two other notorious men also rode with Quantrill's Raiders, Frank and Jesse James. Belle's brother Bud was killed while riding with the Raiders, and after the war ended, she and her family moved to Texas. Belle would go on to marry three outlaws in her life, and they kept company with infamous outlaws and former Quantrill Raiders, Frank and Jesse James, and the Youngers. And over the course of her life, she and her husbands would offer up hideouts for fellow outlaws who were actively evading the law. As to Belle's reputation as the Queen of Outlaws, she was only ever convicted of horse theft. But her mysterious death in 1889 led to Belle becoming a legend. On February the 3rd of 1889, 2 days before Belle's 41st birthday, Belle was riding home from a neighbor's house, relaxed, eating a piece of cornbread. As she was riding, her killer blasted her off her horse. She was shot in the back and died from her wounds. The shooting scene was very close to where Edgar Watson had been staying, and tiny footprints found in the mud at the scene were determined to be the same size as Edgar Watson's unusually small boots. Ed was arrested and tried for the murder of Belle Starr, but he was said to have gotten away with murder when he was acquitted. The murder of Belle Starr, to this day, officially remains unsolved. After Ed Watson was acquitted of Belle Starr's murder, he made his way back to Florida. And while in Arcadia, Florida, that's just east of modern-day Sarasota, his violent nature led him back to murder. Ed was in a land dispute with a man named Quinn Bass. The two fought, and Ed killed Quinn. When the law arrived to question Ed about what happened, he admitted to killing Quinn, but said he had killed him in self-defense. No charges were filed. Ed Watson, once again, got away with murder. In 1892, Ed bought a 40-acre claim on the Chatham Bend River in the 10,000 Islands in the Everglades. 10,000 Islands are a labyrinth of twisting channels through hundreds of remote islands. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the abundance of seafood in the 10,000 Islands area has attracted humans for thousands of years. Prehistoric indigenous populations used the area extensively, constructing large shell complexes on several islands. Early Spanish explorers traded with the native inhabitants, but European diseases decimated the coastal Indian populations. During the late 1880s, white settlers began occupying several of the larger islands. The area became very popular with outlaws, who knew if they could settle in that area, it would be very hard to find them. This is where Ed Watson bought his claim and began raising vegetables and presenting himself to locals as an upstanding farmer. But before long, Ed upgraded his operation and transitioned from vegetables to sugarcane. To folks in the area, Ed seemed like a nice man with a past, but who in the area hadn't run from something? 10,000 Islands was a place that attracted people who had dark secrets. Not long after Ed established his farm, he went to visit relatives in Lake City, Florida. While there, Ed returned to his natural state, fighting and killing. He fought with a man named Sam Toland and ended up shooting him. Ed became known as Bloody Ed, but somehow he was acquitted of Toland's murder. Afterwards, he was given an order by the local sheriff, go home to 10,000 Islands and never come back to Lake City. And Ed did just that. He returned to South Florida and bought more land so he could expand his farming enterprise. Farming became a very lucrative business for Ed. Ed's neighbors on 10,000 Islands and those who lived in Chokoloskee, a village that was near his plantation, came to respect him for his success. Some of them even called him Emperor Watson because of his growing wealth. Ed's talent for farming brought in more and more money, and when he made enough, he invested in the best equipment available to process his sugarcane into cane syrup. He bottled the syrup on site and would take it to the Florida Keys to sell every year. And while in Key West, that darkness within Ed Watson, it once again emerged. Ed attended an auction in Key West and ended up in an argument with a local man named Adolphus Santini. Bloody Ed attacked Santini and slit his throat. As Ed was trying to finish off Santini, bystanders pulled him off of his victim. Santini survived, but Bloody Ed was forced to pay him off to get him to drop the charges of attempted murder. Ed paid Santini $900, which at the time was a small fortune. Once again, Ed Watson returned to 10,000 Islands and bought yet another claim, this time on Lost Man's River. And legend says Ed began to do something he had never been known to do in 10,000 Islands before. He began to kill close to home. A man known as Tucker was squatting on Ed's claim on Lost Man's River and refused to leave. In time, Tucker and his nephew, well, they were found murdered. Residents in the community suspected Ed was responsible, but the closest sheriff lived on an island that was 90 miles away. There was no law enforcement to investigate. So once again, Bloody Ed got away with murder. But Ed's habit of killing and getting away with it was leading to rising tension with residents of 10,000 Islands and nearby Chokoloskee Island. Locals noticed strange things happening on Ed Watson's sugarcane plantation. Allegedly, a new crop of farm workers would arrive at Watson's plantation and then disappear once the season ended. It's said that Ed would kill them once the harvest ended, so he wouldn't have to pay them for their work. Folks called it the Watson payday. He would simply replace the workers the next season. Some locals were also a little uncomfortable with Ed Watson openly employing outlaws, including Dutchie Melvin, who was suspected of killing a lawman. But Ed defended his decision, saying it was hard to find men willing to move to this area of Florida to work in a mosquito-covered swamp. Ed said he had to hire whoever he could convince to join him. And more often than not, it was outlaws who needed a place to hide out and make a living. And two of his outlaw workers were rumored to have killed two people on Watson's property. The body of one of the missing people was later found near Watson's land. Ed also had a habit of using fugitives he hired to strong-arm local landowners into selling him their property so he could continue to expand his operation. This area of Florida was known as a hiding place for people with secrets. But time and time again, Ed Watson seemed to be murdering and rewarding and protecting murderers on his plantation. At least that's how the locals saw it. So much so that they referred to working on Ed's plantation as a surefire way to die. They began to believe that Ed Watson was a madman who killed for sport, and they wondered how he could be stopped. There was no lawman on the island, and things just seemed to be spiraling out of control. Not long after the turn of the century, a little after 1900, a book was published that named Edgar Watson as the likely killer of Belle Starr, the infamous Queen of the Outlaws. Ed's neighbors had heard rumors of this for years, but seeing it in print, well, it seemed to make it real to them. But in true outlaw fashion, Edgar Watson continued to do as he pleased. He had either become so brazen with disposing of bodies or just didn't care anymore. He had escaped prosecution multiple times, and as you can imagine, he felt like he was untouchable, and he seemed to thrive off of being a man feared by those who encountered him. In 1910, fishermen found something floating in the water near Ed Watson's property. At first, they thought they had come across a log or an alligator, but upon closer inspection, they saw a woman's corpse that had been gutted like a fish, and then thrown into the muddy water. The corpse was that of Hannah Smith, a woman who had worked for Ed Watson. Soon after Hannah Smith's body was found, the body of another plantation worker, the outlaw Dutchy Melvin, turned up on Ed Watson's property. One of Ed's former workers told people in the area that he had seen Ed Watson killing people and that he would dispose of them by gutting them so that they would sink. The workers claimed the woods and waters around Ed Watson's property were full of corpses and bones of those Ed had killed. In October of 1910, a few of Ed Watson's neighbors decided to confront him with this rumor. Ed denied that he was a murderer and insisted another worker on his plantation was the one doing the killing. Ed blamed the murders on an outlaw named Leslie Cox. And things took a turn no one expected. Ed Watson traveled to Fort Myers to meet with the sheriff there. He asked the sheriff to deputize him so he could hunt down Leslie Cox and arrest him for the ghastly murders happening in the area. At first, the sheriff refused, saying he was as suspicious of Ed as all of his neighbors had been. But Edgar Watson pressed Sheriff Frank Tippins to investigate, and the sheriff agreed. Now, around this time, it seemed nature was mirroring the upheaval happening in the life of Edgar Watson and his neighbors. A hurricane hit the region around October 17th of 1910. The storm forced the sheriff and Edgar Watson to hunker down on a nearby island called Marco Island. The hurricane of 1910 was estimated to be a Category 4 with winds up to 120 miles per hour. The devastating power of the hurricane left two people dead, and it left the residents of the area with destruction and the overwhelming burden of trying to move forward and rebuild their lives. By the time Edgar Watson returned home, he was alone. The storm forced Sheriff Tippins to head back to Fort Myers to help maintain peace. The devastation of the storm on and around Chokoloskee Island only increased the tension between Ed and the community. And Ed's response was that, deputized or not, he was going to find Leslie Cox and make him pay for his murderous rampage. Ed vowed to catch Leslie Cox, dead or alive. That vow would prove to be Edgar Watson's undoing. Edgar Watson needed one thing before he set out on his mission to catch or kill Leslie Cox. He needed ammunition. So Edgar Watson headed for Ted Smallwood's store on a small island in Chokoloskee Bay. The trading post served the remote and isolated area, buying hides, furs, and produce in exchange for providing the goods required for residents to survive. It was the ideal location for fugitives and all manner of people who needed supplies to sustain them. Late in October of 1910, Edgar Watson walked into Smallwood's store to buy pistol and shotgun ammunition. He boasted that he was heading out to kill Leslie Cox. Now, the owner of the store, Ted Smallwood, he was said to have never had an issue with Edgar Watson. Ed paid his bills on time, and that's what mattered to Ted. But Ted Smallwood's wife, she didn't like Ed Watson, and she didn't trust him. So it's said that on that day when Ed demanded to buy ammunition, she intentionally sold him ammo that had been waterlogged when the hurricane hit the area days before. None the wiser, Ed Watson headed off on his mission to find and kill the outlaw, Leslie Cox. While Edgar Watson was away, the locals around Chokoloskee Island and 10,000 Islands, well, they gathered together and decided that it was time to put an end to Watson and his thirst for blood. They decided that if the law wouldn't come help them, they would take the law into their own hands. A posse of about 20 armed men gathered and put together a plan to capture Ed Watson and turn him in to the closest sheriff that was 90 miles away. They wanted Ed Watson to finally face justice for his crimes. A few days later, Ed Watson returned from his mission and found the armed and angry posse waiting for him at the landing that was behind Ted Smallwood's store. Ed Watson told everyone to calm down and gloated that he had the man responsible for all the crimes they were blaming him for. Ed said he had found Leslie Cox and killed him so they could all rest easy now. But the posse wasn't after Leslie Cox. They had found the man they wanted. One of the men yelled at Ed Watson, telling him to take off his holstered pistol and move away from the shotgun he had nearby. Then they told Ed Watson their plan. Once Ed Watson heard they planned to take him to the sheriff, he raised one of his guns to fire, but nothing happened. Ed Watson had no idea he had water-damaged ammo that Ted Smallwood's wife had sold him. All the posse saw in that moment was a man going for his gun, and that was enough to move about a dozen men to start firing. As Ed Watson was shot time and time again, he was said to have continued to try to walk towards the men killing him. Legend says it was the demon killer inside him that propelled him forward. Or maybe it was the fact that before he even hit the ground, Ed Watson had been hit by dozens of bullets. A few men took Ed Watson's bullet-riddled corpse, tied it to the back of a small boat, and dragged it through the swamp to what was known as Rabbit Key. They dumped Watson's body into a muddy pit and promptly buried him. When the sheriff was informed of what had happened, he ordered that Ed Watson's body be exhumed for examination and found that Ed had 33 bullet wounds. The sheriff said the men shot in self-defense and refused to arrest them. No one was ever prosecuted for Edgar Watson's death. Edgar Watson admitted to killing a few men in self-defense and may have killed Belle Starr. But questions linger to this day as to whether Watson really killed as many people as he was rumored to have killed around Chatham Bend. After his death, the investigation into the killings stopped. Leslie Cox was never found and questioned as to whether he had been involved. There are many theories about the Chatham Bend killings. Some believe Watson really was a genuine serial killer, hell-bent on killing anyone who crossed him, and that he was a madman who treated killing as a sport. Others believe Watson was framed by some of his neighbors who were full of envy over his success. Maybe they eliminated the competition so they could thrive. Another theory is that the outlaw Leslie Cox took part in the killings with Edgar Watson. The Chatham Bend murders are still a mystery, with the remains of victims likely still drifting around in the muddy water, around the swampland that was once Edgar Watson's plantation. In the years since Edgar Watson was killed, the land that was once his plantation has been said to be haunted by his alleged victims and by Watson. And the unsettling story of his life and the men who took the law into their own hands lingers in modern-day culture. The Decemberists retold the story of the posse that faced Edgar Watson on that fateful day in 1910 in their song, E. Watson. As the lyrics go, "Till I'm dust, I'll never know why he came ashore with all those killers gathered on the shoreline, kicking holes in ugly mud, trigger fingers pinched. Brace your rifles, bristled in the wind, and we towed his body northbound, buried him all face down, with a good view into hell." Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can hear the song E. Watson on the Decemberist EP, Long Live the King. And if you'd like to read a fictionalized version of Edgar Watson's life and death, read Peter Matthiessen's Edgar Watson trilogy. You can find links to the books and more about Edgar Watson and the mysterious Everglades at southernmysteries.com. Remember to subscribe to Southern Mysteries in iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or any podcast player of your preference. Just search for Southern Mysteries Podcasts to find the show in your player. And if you're enjoying Southern Mysteries, be sure to rate and review the show in your podcast player to help folks who are looking for a new podcast know that they should listen too. It's an easy way to support Southern Mysteries and help spread the word. Thanks for listening.